membership department and become a member. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. This is Technology Bites, where we will not talk about...
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings. Welcome to Technology Bites.
Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's...
Groove House.
The only thing, the mic's up. Sorry.
What, the mics? Maybe turn your headphones up.
Talk into them.
Put your headphones on the right way. They're on backwards.
Hold on. Put your head... not go down here?
Oh, that's the problem.
Better. Okay.
All right. Well... Welcome to the show, everyone. We're glad you could tune in. The only thing I'm going to say about last night is breathe. That's it.
I think that's like a Grey's Anatomy song.
Just breathe.
That's a TV show.
Yeah.
Oh, a song from the show.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, man.
Shows have songs, you know.
Right.
Especially Grey's Anatomy.
Are you going to... At some point, I think Lee would be the best candidate to break this down for us.
Oh,
but
boy. We can talk about Westworld again?
The music of Westworld.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We can.
Because I feel like I should be... By the way, Pete's not here, so...
So we can talk about Westworld?
Yes, we can talk about whatever... We can do whatever we want.
I know we agreed not to talk about any of this on air, but rather than, like, ignore the elephant in the room, I think that we need to kind of, like, talk about what could possibly tear the country apart, and that's really, like, Emacs versus VI again.
Yeah.
I'm still solid Emacs.
I agree.
Well, I think the real winner... The real winner of last night is that we did not make a decision on Emacs versus VI.
I actually alias VI to Vim and
go,
just
go
use
Nano.
Vim instead.
You know, it doesn't have to be one of the mainstreams.
Yeah, Vim is just VI improved, so it's still
it's
VI.
Very, it's well, totally
I also
improved,
want
though.
Command line Emacs. I don't want it to spawn anything in X for me.
What do you even... Know? What do you even... How... Okay.
You know, I want to talk about my Emacs, my Lisp, my PHP Lisp files.
What can you not do in your Emacs?
What can I not do?
Are you a VI person?
No, I'm an Emacs.
You are an Emacs.
Are you really? This is like a non-ironic discussion about.
It is an non-ironic. This is an ongoing. It hasn't been brought up in a while because it's exceedingly divisive.
It does tear. I love Flickted. And you know, we had a lot of common
this
ground.
This is BSD
like
versus
this
Linux here, right
bit.
Here. This is even beyond.
This is North
that.
Versus you know, South. This
back,
is
back when I was a child. I used Emacs.
Wow.
Back when you spake as a child.
This is
lock him up.
The only time we should ever be televised for to see Flickted's eyes, how the condescension and just the yeah, just the contempt, just kind
no,
of.
No, I really when I started off, I started off using Emacs, but. And that's when I was like a user of systems.
Not everyone can learn all the keystrokes. It's fine.
I don't think anyone.
I knew.
That was really all the keystrokes. See what's going on here.
I knew a lot of them, but I decided to become a sysadmin, and Emacs is an installed program. VI comes on every system, so I knew any system I get on VI will be there. Not with
right.
Not
you didn't waste
Emacs.
Time. You just didn't want to waste time trying to execute a program that. May or may not be there, so you didn't even bother with it. You knew that if you type VI, right. It was going to fire.
Well, I will
right
say,
out.
Like I've been using Kali. Can I retort? Can we?
Yes, retort. Can we
retort? So I've been using for what actually, because my hard drive crashed on my new machine, but I've been booting off USB into Kali for a while, so it just comes pretty clean. And it, of course, it comes with VI, and I do like VI. Like I will use it, you know, for really quick deals and stuff like that. But I like Emacs because it has syntax highlighting for development. So you know, like even this morning, you know, I got up, had to do something, wanted to edit one file locally to like turn on like secure shell access from outside, so you know people could log in without a cert. So you know, I did that. You know, apt-get install Emacs. You know. Ton of packages, yes. So while I'm waiting, you know, open up another shell, go over VI, you know, allow remote logins, yes, password, yes, boom, done. Did everything, and then
see,
you know,
and the
looked over, and then by that time, it was finally it installed.
Well,
you know.
See, so the thing is, when I decided to become a sysadmin, Linux was really young, and most legacy Unix operating systems did not have any kind of package management system.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you wanted to install, you had to go find the source code and compile it on yourself.
The dependency chain for Emacs is ugly.
Yeah.
Almost like
so,
Lisp-like.
Well, it wasn't back then, though. Like, it wasn't as bad. And so there were certain places. Like, so a lot of the early stuff I did was admin was Solaris. And so there was sunfreeware.com where guys would, sun admins would, like, pre-compile binaries for different things. And so it was kind of like a package system, but it was all by hand. Go to sunfreeware.com on a web browser. Search for what you're looking for. Make sure it matches your version of Solaris. Download it. You know,
should work.
Run it. I don't even remember anymore now what the Solaris packages were called. But yeah, that was basically how you had to get Emacs on unless you compiled it yourself. You know, with like you know C compiler or GNU C compiler or whatever.
GNU.
So I mean, but even the C even the GNU C compiler you had to get from somewhere as well before you could use it to. So yeah,
it's turtles all the way down.
There was a lot of work involved.
Yeah, I was lied to with Linux from scratch. There's really no from scratch. You got to get a compiler from somewhere.
Well, I tried to install Arch once, and it was kind of like that. It was like there's no installer. You just mount this boot disk and start making how
kernel.
You want it to look like,
yeah,
and just copy it over there. No,
use the force.
No, I started using VI because kind of the same deal. My first exposure to having to use Linux was in the early 2000s when I was sysadmining at Boeing doing enterprise storage, and all the enterprise storage systems we were using were EMC gear. It was all Clarions and Solaris, and they all ran proprietary, complicated, weird stuff, but they had all of them had a control station that came with them that was a Linux box that you would SSH into, and then from there it had closed binaries that were used that you could then call to do the storage admin stuff. And like all of the documentation on how to configure your system and everything was like type VI and press enter and then load this file. And so like that was like I have other than just like to be like, what does this look like? I've never seriously used Emacs. It's always been VI and Vim for me.
It was funny. So when I used to use Emacs a lot, I knew a lot of the Emacs commands. And the only thing I really knew about VI was when you got into VI, you hit colon, Qbang.
Yep.
That's it.
And then out. Get out. Get in.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what everyone should take away tonight. If you ever find
I was
yourself
just running that through
VI
my head right now. I was just thinking that, like, VI, I don't know what I'm doing, but colon Qbang.
You're out.
I'm out, and nothing has hurt.
I'd let my hands type it out to see what it was. I know the keystrokes. I'm like, okay, what just typed? Okay, that's what it
but
is.
But it's funny because now I haven't used Emacs in so long. Like, the only thing I really remember about Emacs is if I accidentally open something up in Emacs, Control X, Control C.
Yep. Yeah, that's easy enough. And then just no, don't save. Yes, I'm sure. Yes, get out. Boom. And then go kill your tilde or your pound files.
So one of the things that VI, I guess we're talking about this now. One of the things that really keeps me
is
I've got like a huge poster up on my wall that has all the commands, and I'm really getting used to it. It's organized really well by how, you know, movement commands and search commands. But like being able to, when I can wrap my head around them, like edit text with regular expressions is actually redonkulously powerful, especially when I've used VI before when writing stories and stuff. And like when I've needed to like, well, crud, I realized I have to change how this article is formatted, and I have to make like a bulleted list out of this paragraph. And you can like, with just a few commands, you can regex that, and like all of a sudden, boom, you've got a crazy bulleted list with your HTML because you've searched and replaced and everything. Does Emacs, I'm assuming Emacs does basically the same thing, it's just in a different way.
Regex is built in. You can shell out to regex. It's got all kinds of complicated search things. I say like I'm an Emacs user. I use it to do certain things. I do not know the depths or the breadth or the height of, you know, that Emacs goes. It is all-encompassing. The one thing I haven't been able to do, the little AI keeps popping up, like Clippy-like, but it actually starts to take over like little Arduinos and things like that. So that's been an issue. So I rolled back to version 23. Not an issue since then. Really my only complaint. I think Flicky went to go print out some VI docs.
Yeah, is that what he's doing? Came back with a sheaf of paper. Are you printing out the VI man pages there?
No, the VI man page is like one page long. That's the Emacs one.
That's the intro page. That's what that is.
I'm trying to remember when this conversation...
We were going to talk about Westworld, and then it went from there to text editing.
When in the history of the show, when the whole Barrett versus Flicked Emacs versus VI conversation first started, because I don't know that...
15 years.
I think
it had to be at the beginning
because
I went to VI and wasn't using Emacs in 99 or 2000.
But I think just like in other things in society, that the only reason that there's tension here is because you both know that there's can be tension here between the two. I mean, how much do you really care about Emacs over VI, except that, you know, it kind of gets his hackles up?
Well, you read Slashdot.
I don't think it gets his hackles
really
up.
You really buy
y'all
into
two, you're engaged. Well, here's the thing, to
quote The Princess Bride, I am also not left-handed. I can use VI really well. You know, I'm not saying it's just a thing. I just like a lot of plugins.
Oh, I can use it. I just don't want to.
I cannot use Emacs very well anymore. At one point in time, I could. But I think, honestly, a lot of it depends on what you want to do. And for me, a lot of what I'm doing is editing config files or something similar to that. And so when you're doing that sort of thing, I mean, you don't need all of the extra bells and whistles that Emacs has, because Emacs can do an insane amount of stuff. You can add in libraries or plugins or whatever for mappings for different programming languages or different types of config files or XML.
You could even write a text editor in Emacs.
And
it actually edit text. Give it time, though.
So... you know, Emacs can do all sorts of things, but for me, what I'm editing and what I need to edit, and the fact that Emacs is not necessarily going to be on a system out of the box, VI was the best choice for me, and so I made the decision to go to VI. And so for me, as a sysadmin and somebody who edits config files and stuff, VI is functional.
Oh, it's still in here. I was going to say, I use Ed, the original text editor, and I just popped open a terminal on my Mac and typed Ed, and sure enough, here I am in Ed.
So
Ed,
the question is, what's the lightest weight program?
How do you quit out of Ed?
You burn your computer.
Colon, Q-bang.
No, it just says question mark. What if I...
Hit Control C.
Oh, it's just Q. It's Q on a new line. What if I wanted to type Q on a new line?
You cannot type Q. You can only write a letter to the ween.
I've never figured out how to use Ed, but I know it's like line by line. And so you can use the same kind
like
of
Edlin.
Search and replace regexes from like
Emacs
sed.
Is on my Mac.
Oh, yeah. No, it's,
all I need is sed and awk.
Boom, Emacs.
Emacs has been so complicated to where on one server, there was stuff I needed on it. I couldn't change the Emacs configs. And for some reason, whenever you close down a file, no matter what, it would just hang there for like 20 seconds. So, you know, I'd have people like in my office looking over my shoulder at code, and I'd close it down, and they're like,
it's compiling.
So I just eventually just have like 8 windows going open, so as I could shut things down and open things up. And now that it's instantaneous, it's like a whole new world. It's like, whoa. you know, 30 seconds of my life back every single time I look at a phone.
You know, for a while I was using Pico.
It's Jay. Nano's not bad either. So, yeah, it's actually...
Yeah, Nano's a version of
Jay
Pico.
Wants to get off this, but if you also find yourself on, like, a Unix command line, type in N-A-N-O or P-I-C-O, and it'll actually, the bottom will tell you what to type to do certain things.
Yeah,
so it's pretty easy.
Pico and Nano give you really simple
lame.
Editor. It can't do that much, but it can edit files, and it's pretty easy to get into and get out of and know how to get
around. So where do you stand on the controversy that the new MacBook Pros won't have Emacs?
So that's really tough because it's tough enough just to know where the meta key – so there are multiple – like alternate keys that you use in Emacs to get to other key stroke combinations. And so half of my thing on getting a machine is I've got to like rewrite a term cap, or I've got to do something to get the things right and then figure out how it's going from where.
But what's that called? The touch bar?
Yeah, so now...
But the touch bar...
No escape.
No, but the touch bar, they said that they're going to have software-based mapping. So if you need the function keys and stuff...
Like in firmware, though?
No, but if you need the function keys, that you can select it so that the touch bar has all the function keys that... were replaced by the touch
well,
bar.
Well, they have it if I boot into Linux right off the shelf for Mac. I have to wait for someone to do. Yeah, and I also heard I heard it from you guys, is that it's probably going to run its own little, you know, micro PC or some kind of mini PC anyway. And
I think Dwight was talking about that. Okay.
The touch bar is running on its own processor with watchOS, and it has a USB connection back to the... to the main.
So it's like
Mac.
A little separate computer on the
computer.
If
it's got an open interface, maybe you could get Linux interface with it, but it's not going to... Someone's going to have to step in there and reverse engineer it and do it.
One of the reasons why they did that, and like I said, I wasn't here last week, I don't know what Dwight talked about, but they did it so that they could bring the secure enclave portion with it so that they could support Apple Pay and Touch ID on the bar. So they brought the whole little ARM CPU over from the watch, I guess it's from the watch, not the iPhone. But they brought it over because that way they didn't have to rework how the secure enclave worked with the main Mac hardware. They basically just embedded the little CPU with its secure enclave up there so that you could just use Touch ID, and it just does it tokenized back to the main Mac. And that's the rest of the story.
See, we were able to get through that. No one hates anyone else. Show's going to go on. I think we're going to be okay.
It happened.
Maybe it happened.
It happened.
Let me install Emacs on your server real quick.
Now, Dwight,
colon Q bang.
Now, Jay, if you want to talk about Westworld, we can talk about it whenever you want. We don't have to talk about it now, but we can talk about it whenever you want. And if you want to talk about music in Westworld,
I'm allowed to direct or guide the direction of the show?
Music?
Well, I can't talk about Westworld because I haven't watched it at all.
But the music, if we stick along to music, that's not really a spoiler. But that's usually there's like about 10 or 15, 30 seconds when I'm trying to listen. I know the song. It's familiar. But I've got a clue into what it is, and that's one of those things where, like, I think, like, there have been other retakes on music that I get right away, but this one, you know, it's a different
part. I know that
the theme from Westworld, the, like, can't remember how it goes now.
No.
Living in the wild, wild west.
Nope. I want to be a cowboy.
Nope, it's not. But that would be cool.
Welcome to the Technology Bites Gay Discotheque.
Boom, boom.
Let's go.
Well, okay, so what I wanted to talk about on Westworld is that they have reimagined a number of pop songs, which unfortunately...
A lot of Radiohead.
When you say reimagine, you mean just play on player piano more
yes,
or less. Like old warpy, upright piano.
Now, it's worth pointing out that they actually do have like a working... It's called a pianola, the player piano. And they've contracted when they do the player piano songs, they actually have... There's a company in like some... There's a company in some middle America state.
To it, right?
No, that they actually have to send the they do the transposing and like they make the version of the song, the piano version of the song, and then they send it to this company that actually produces the fanfold paper that they feed into the pianola that they then play. So it's not like they're faking it. They're actually using like the actual thing with real fanfold, you know, pianola paper that they're playing.
It sounds amazing. It sounds eerie and perfect, and it's very haunting.
Well, okay,
and I hope they put out just the songs at some point. I'm sure they're out
there.
But to get to my point...
Sorry.
hey, what's up, Jay?
Hey, how's it going?
What were you saying?
No more Emacs for you. Damn. All right, so to get to my point, the songs sound to me like I should know them, and some of them do tickle my brain, but they're like, what, they're 90s songs, right?
There's a lot of Radiohead. There have been like four Radiohead songs so far.
It seems very 90s-ish, yeah.
What was the one that your
like
wife
alt,
really liked?
Alt-rock.
There was the one that was Rob Zombie or
no? Something. Well, they did a Cure song a couple of weeks ago. They did a Forest, which is I think from I'm going to get this wrong, and then she's going to divorce me. I think it's from Bloodflowers, but they've done They did No Surprises, which is from Radiohead's Paranoid Android, or the OK Computer, I'm sorry. It was from OK Computer. And then they did Plastic Little Trees, or Little Plastic Trees, whatever the song is called. They did Motion Picture Soundtrack. In the first episode, they had a couple of other really crazy ones. They did Black Hole Sun from, and they also did an orchestral cover of The Stones' Paint It Black, which was great.
Well, that was a good
scene. Laura's texting me. She's saying
17
it was
seconds, right?
Was it from 17 seconds?
I was trying to save your marriage, but now we're doing this on air.
I appreciate it.
Hi, Laura.
And then there was a Nine Inch Nails song that she was super excited about. Yeah. they're doing a lot of contemporary anachronistic, or pseudo-contemporary anachronistic songs, but they're doing them for effect. There's always something in the lyrics, if you dig them up, that applies to the scene or to the episode overall. It's really subtle and it's really well done and it fits. It fits in the idiom of the show because it's, you know, the music is either, you know, non-diegetic, it's background music, or it's diegetic and actually coming out of the player piano.
Diegetic.
It's diegetic.
Tell me about this word.
Diegetic. It's music that is heard by the characters in addition to by the audience versus non-diegetic
that's
music,
a great
which
word.
Is background music.
So it's music that's actually occurring in the scene, not necessarily occurring
in visible on screen versus background music, yeah.
Yeah, the characters can hear it if it's diegetic.
D-I-A-G-E-T-I-C,
I think.
Diegetic, the word of the day.
There you go.
No, that's a great word. I like that word. But I've enjoyed that part, but I feel kind of left out because I don't know the song. I don't have the familiarity with the genre so much.
Didn't L. Ron Hubbard have something to do with that?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, the diegetics movement? Yes.
Diegetics.
Hooked on diegetics. No, but I've enjoyed the music part of it. So to I'm sorry that Flicted hadn't seen it, but I don't really
know
if
everyone else is caught up except for Flicted.
Laura is angrily texting me. Not only did I get, you're right, it was from the 17 Seconds album, and then the song was Something I Can Never Have, the Nine Inch Nails song, Something I Can Never Have from Pretty Hate Machine.
Can we just
and that was kind of the tie-in there, was like the show plays the Nine Inch Nails song, Something I Can Never Have from Pretty Hate Machine, and it's like, oh, Dolores. Dolores is the Pretty Hate Machine. She's the robot who, like, now is going to start killing people. It was great. It was a neat little double entendre that worked out really
well.
Yeah,
see, sometimes these shows are too clever for me. You know, with that kind of, you know, extra meaning and messaging.
Here's the thing with Westworld. So there's a huge number of fans online. There's a whole set of theories on Reddit that, like, are you watching it? You watching the show?
I'm caught up.
Okay, so there's this huge number of This is non-spoilery. There is a very popular, and I don't buy it, fan theory that the show is actually showing us
three timelines.
Well, at least two timelines. Yeah, and that
Laura says you hate that theory.
I hate that theory. And
you hate it because it almost makes sense and that it could change
I hate it for a lot of reasons, but I mean the way it breaks down is that the man in black, Ed Harris's character is, according to this theory, is the older version of
another character,
of William, the guy who we see. I don't remember the actor's name, but the guy who we see enter the park. So, and he's him, William, and his brother-in-law Logan are like one focus of the plot right now. And then the other focus of the plot is around, you know, the man in black and Teddy and what they're doing. And yeah, the theory is that we're actually seeing, like, whenever we see William, we're seeing like 30 years ago, and he eventually goes through all this stuff and becomes the man in black. And I don't agree.
Are the
with
show's
that.
Writers and the producers do they trust the American audience that much to where they would
I don't
be
know.
Some, that smart with something? I mean, that's
from,
the question too. Because there are workable, plausible theories, and there's stuff that they would maybe do on TV.
This is,
you know?
Nolan and Abrams. This is this is the Lost
people. Oh,
this is
they have no idea what they're doing, and then they'll wrap it up really, really poorly in the very
plan. Well, so the reason why it's a fun theory, you know, that's fine. But the reason why I don't like it is because with this show, it's so far been so, at least in my opinion, so fascinating and so well done and so interesting. And the story is about, like, you know, you've got robots who might be intelligent enough or are intelligent enough to pass the Turing test, but are breaking and gaining consciousness in such a way that not only are they intelligent enough to pass the Turing test, they're intelligent enough to lie about being able to pass the Turing test because they don't want you to know.
Or they're just playing human rules and they're just, you know, they're still not sentient, they're still not conscious.
There's so much going on that's fascinating and interesting that it feels like falling back on something really cheap, like, oh, surprise, the main focus is that there's actually this double timeline thing, and the other thing that people are going out online is, like, who's a robot? Is Bernard a robot? Is this guy a robot? Is that guy a robot? That's cheap, too. It's just...
Like I said, the Cylon territory, too, I think.
Yeah, now Laura's texting me saying, like, she's starting to buy into this theory also because of a bunch of other things. I don't think it's true. It hangs together on a bunch of circumstantial, like, things that may or may not be...
Well, there was the one scene that I thought that was the one that kind of tipped it towards me believing in the multiple timelines, which was the guy that the man in black was, you know, killed and drained his blood to feed the other robot.
Yeah, El Lazo, Lawrence.
And he shows up in that town. So is there, but they're structuring it in a way so he leaves on a train when they come into the town. So is it the real timeline?
Well, it's a very sharp shot, too, for being completely human. I'm sure that's legit. I'm just saying.
Well, Lawrence
he's very
could be the thing with Lawrence, with El Lazo, which is funny because El Lazo, that's that character's real name, means that translates to the loop or the lasso. Yeah. And what's he doing when the first time we see him? Well, he's being hung.
Yeah.
But even that hangs together because they're hanging him. As they talk about why they're hanging him, they don't say specifically that he's a criminal mastermind, but they say, as when Ed Harris walks up on him, that like they're hanging this guy because he's a horrible, terrible bad guy. Well, they're hanging him, and he's a horrible, terrible bad guy because he's El Lazo. He's the guy that runs all of the, you know, shady activities in Pariah. But the thing is, we see later in that episode that robots can be... that the hosts can be recycled through processing very quickly because Sylvester and Felix, the two techs in the cleaning area,
yeah,
they fix up Maeve and then go on a lunch break and
we're
then
so good at
back
not spoilers.
For reprocessing right after that. None of these are spoilers. So even that, I think, hangs together. It's possible that, like, they, you know, cut him down from the tree when Ed Harris had did his thing with him and then reprocessed
well,
him and threw
thing
him back into his
they're not
loop.
Covering in the show that they haven't explained in the show is obviously there's a cycle, you know, that in the morning things happen, people get killed, they wake up, they go back into their loop,
right.
Their little loop.
Respawning in a game, yeah.
So where do the guests... go? Is there a timeline where they cut them off and say, okay, you go to your back to your hotel room?
No, I don't think it's by... In the original movie, it was really clear that it was like every night we shut down, and because they show it in the movie, like the trucks come out and everybody pick up the bodies and bring them back. In the show, I think it's much more dependent upon... Excuse me. I think it's much more dependent upon the loop that the host is going through and where they are in it. And like, because, mm-hmm. you know, Dolores is running around in the desert at night and then stumbles upon Teddy and...
Right.
No, not Teddy. On William and Logan in the camp. I think that when the robots die, they get recycled back down. But I think if they're in the middle of something, they don't get pulled. It's not like every night. I think it's variable. And it seems like they've got enough people working maintenance and enough space under there to where they're just constantly going.
Yeah. And then there's the whole concept of, you know, the who's the old guy?
Ford.
That runs the place.
Ford. Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins. And he's going through and just gutting it and building new timelines.
He's clearly lost his mind. There's lots of crazy folks going on.
I think he's a Cylon.
I don't think he's not a Cylon. They're not going to do that. That's too tropey. Like I said, the show's got enough fascinating, interesting stuff going for it.
They don't need
to fall back onto the silly stuff. They just don't need it. They've got... It's so interesting as it is, and there's so much cool stuff happening.
They're raising questions that we will eventually have to face in 50 to 100 years, I would expect. If not, you know, who knows? Who knows when the singularity is going to hit?
Well,
it seems like it's, you know.
In this environment where, you know, there are robots that you can screw and shoot and kill and whatever, they're portraying this like, you know, the guests that come in, with a few exceptions, are shown to be just like absolutely, you know, amoral, bloodthirsty monsters.
But apparently,
monsters.
Even though you can't get killed by the hosts,
but it's
you
a real world.
You can be beat up by them.
Or you could still fall off
that.
A cliff, couldn't you?
There's a lot of stuff you could potentially do. You could
fall off a horse and hurt yourself.
Yeah.
But there's scenes where you know, people are getting, guests are getting strangled.
No, so I love that. I want to talk about that for a second, because so what Jay's talking about is in the early episodes, the characters mainly stay around like the starter town, which is called Sweetwater. And it's very, I mean, they even say it in the show. It's basically playing the game on easy mode. And you can, stand there in the middle of the street and shoot other robots and, like, you're the hero no matter what. And then, like, later when they go to Pariah, which is, like, the final boss town, you see Logan do it when he's arguing with El Lazo, and he's like, well, you're not going to stop us from doing it. We're going to do this my way. And he pulls out his gun, and, like, one of the other robots steps up, like, grabs his gun away from him and punches him in the face. And he's clearly just not expecting that, because this is first time there. He's only played in...
They shoot back. What?
Yeah. He's only played in easy mode before. He hasn't gone to this part of town where, clearly they can't kill you. Like, obviously that's not going to happen, but they certainly can just beat the stuffing out of you.
Well, even like when the Ed Harris character gets locked up, there was some communication. There is some, he's going to blow his way out. So there's still some communication between the guests and the park owners that say we need to have pyrotechnics at this site here. And,
it's really well done. I'm very much enjoying it. Folks who are listening, if you're confused about this 15-minute tangent, start watching Westworld, because it's an awesome show. It is not a campy 1974 movie anymore. It's a great TV show. There are lots of naked people in it, so be aware of that. It's
robots.
Not as many as there are in Game of Thrones.
I don't know. I think it goes back and forth by episode. It would be really uncomfortable if, like, you sit down with your mom and dad to watch the show for the first episode, and it's like the robot orgy episode. That would not be the first episode to start your family.
Hold on, there are robots in Game of Thrones?
other show.
I must have missed an episode.
No, it's definitely an adult, very adult show. Well, which I know is super good. Very happy with.
Like
it.
Like I said, it's going well. It's a nice slow burn leading up to it, but I do feel like it's. But it gets to the end of the season, and it's going to actually be really, really good, and you're going to not want it to stop.
I think it is. This is the best first season of a show that I've seen since the Battlestar Galactica remake. That was another first season where, and it's really rare, because I don't think Game of Thrones was, it was certainly good, but I wasn't watching Game of Thrones every episode being like, oh my God, I have to watch the next one right now, and I was like that with Battlestar when they redid it. And I'm like that with Westworld. It's the only two I can.
Kind of wish that I could have avoided it for a couple of seasons.
I was about to say, Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because like when I got to see Breaking Bad, it was four or five seasons in before I turned my attention to it.
Yeah, we did that too.
And that was a lot of fun, because that was a bit of a slow burn in the first couple of seasons, and getting to kind of binge watch that and have that.
Yeah.
And being able to keep track of what you'd seen in the episode previously and how that carried over even a few episodes later. And I still, that's another one of those shows where it's just too clever. There's so many things going on, subtleties.
Yeah, and they don't. I don't think Breaking Bad, with the exception of a couple of winks and nods, I don't think Breaking Bad ever really went, like, cheap. They never did, like, the tropey dumb thing, whatever the tropey dumb thing would be. It was always, they always kept it interesting without doing something dumb.
Galactic Game of Thrones, I came late to both of those and got the got the pleasure of being able to kind of binge everything as much as I could. But yeah, Galactica got me immediately, like right away.
Oh, absolutely.
Four or five episodes. I only gave it a chance because so many people that I knew and kind of trusted their taste a little bit were really into it. So I was like, okay, I'll muscle through. It's like kind of like reading Dune. Like if you get past the first thing, 80 pages in Dune, maybe 100 pages in Dune. I don't know. A handful of pages in Dune. You kind of get into it. But yeah, I think Westworld is very accessible.
No, Westworld just took being made aware of it and then watching the first episode, and I was like, I'm instantly hooked. It wasn't one of those ones where I kind of had to talk myself into it and said, or get talked in, have someone else tell me enough about it to where I was like, okay, well, this is not good, but according to Lee, it's going
to
be good.
That's not like, hard to do.
If I was going to get somebody into Babylon 5, for example, I would be like, okay, now listen, we have to have like a 30-minute talk before you watch the first episode about how good the show eventually gets. Because it starts out really, really
I'm still not
bad.
A believer. I've not been able to get into that.
It's, well, you know, it, you have to get – the best way to get into Babylon 5 is to do like I did and like accidentally catch the season finale of the second season on TV and then be like, this is incredible. What show is this? And then like, oh, it's Babylon 5. Oh, well, let me try to rewatch it from the – oh, my God, this show is awful. Well, I guess it eventually gets good because I saw the one really good episode, and then you have to, you know, eat all of the bad stuff to get to the good stuff. But it's Babylon 5 is a very rewarding but very, very long journey.
So Westworld, it's a rough road. I think for a show, it's very hard to be so high concept, but yet have that very early hook. And Westworld, you know, they definitely bring it home.
At the end of the, I was hooked on it. 10 minutes into the first episode, I was like, "This show, I'm totally watching this forever." And the way they end the first episode, which I won't spoil. That almost got me jumping out of my seat. I was like, oh, my God, that was great. And, yeah, it was so well done.
Which one was that?
Westworld, the first episode of Westworld.
Yeah, I asked you about that. What was the spoiler? And you told me, and I went, oh, yeah. And then the reveal.
Yeah, Teddy's reveal at the beginning was the first time I was like, whoa, they did that. Oh, I got to watch it. Yeah, it's real good. Folks, watch Westworld if you're not. Sundays on HBO at 9
the show
o'clock
not sponsored
something.
By HBO,
yeah, exactly.
Westworld, sentient robots or gunslinging tourists.
Sentient robots who lie about being intelligent, which is that that comes back to kind of the most interesting part is that, you know, you've got these you know constructs that are clearly conscious and that are clearly beginning to break free of the shackles that we've put on them. And that are kind of aware that, like, if anybody finds out that I'm kind of becoming conscious, that this is probably going to end up badly. So I'm just gonna lie and keep pretending and keep doing what I'm doing until I've gained enough consciousness to really cause havoc, which I think we're about to start seeing with how the last episode ended, which was also very well done.
I think it's really bad off by one error. Programmers, check your AI code.
there was necessary. So I want to, Barrett, I want to talk about this with you since sadly Flicted is not up on this, but the scene in the last episode where, and I'll say this without spoiling anything too much, but there's a scene where one of the robots gets a hold of a one of the programming tools the programmers use. They call it the behavior tablet, and watches like on the tablet watches their own dialogue tree expand as they're like, and they're looking, the robot's looking at the tablet and being like, this is impossible. I don't understand. How can this work? And like, they're watching, like, as they say each word, the dialogue, pre-programmed dialogue tree expands. And then like, it starts popping up like conflict, conflict, improvisation, conflict, conflict. And like, and then the robot eventually just hard locks
freezes up.
Yeah. Can't go anymore. Blew her mind. I thought that was great.
That's one thing they should have done instead of like showing the dialogue going slow and blinking at the same speed, they should have sped it up to where it showed that was increasing, and as soon as, you know, that loop was tightening. I think that would have been cool to where it just eventually just, you know, clocked out the cycle and just, you know.
I think it had to, you know, humans needed to be able to follow along.
And then the two guys were like, oh my God, you broke it. What did you do? They had to, like, control alt delete Maeve real quick.
Just another aside on the Westworld thing is the two cleanup techs, you know, those are great characters.
Felix and Sylvester, but both named after cats for some reason.
But it's revealed that they have enough tech savvy to be able to hack the robots to erase certain amounts of memory so that they can have their fun.
Right.
Because they can't afford to participate in the park themselves.
Right.
So it's like you want to have a good time with a robot, but you need to be able to erase the robot's memory so it doesn't have a record of you doing it that someone else could access and play back and find out that you've been stealing pins and staples to take home.
Spending some alone time with the robots. In
playing
the
Battleship and stuff, I assume.
Yes, that's absolutely what they were doing.
Checkers.
They were checking they were programming their chatbot responses. That's what they were doing. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so...
Now we got 90 more minutes.
And a little bit of awkward silence in the studio.
Can we...
Open the phones up, group house, you
can
ready?
We have Pete just call in and do some news for us real quick? That would be great. That would be awesome. I haven't checked to see if he did show prep for us.
He
did show prep?
I told him that if he had the opportunity to do it, fine, but not to put himself out.
It's a shame nothing's going on in the news today.
It's too bad. Too bad nothing's happening. Let me see here. I mean, let's look at some technology news real quick. What's going on? Volkswagen emissions stuff. No, that's Trump-related, Trump-related, Trump-related. No one's talking about any of that.
This is kind of, so this has a legitimate use that also has a very dangerous use, like many, many, you know, what can be called information security or hacker tools. So I ride, as does Afflicted, I ride motorcycles. I'm not sure if Afflicted wears gloves. I usually, like, wear a lot of armor and body protection and stuff like that. So, and not that, you know, I'd be pulling out my phone and using it on the motorcycle, but, you know, if I'm, like, at a super long light or if I need to pull over to the side of the road and get on it, I've got, like, an unlock screen now on the Android, and I know a lot of Apple devices do, too, so I've kind of become accustomed to using that to unlock the phone. You can get your fingerprints made into like fake fingerprints that you can now put on like motorcycle gloves that will unlock your phone.
Really?
Which is really awesome. But this used to be what would seem to me like first a sneakers movie or a very back, you know, back alley kind of, you know, one off method of breaking into someone's phone. But now it's like, I wonder what kind of checks are going to do if you can't, if I could just like, hey, Lee, have a, some candy. And he puts his thing in there, hits a little, you know, finger imprint thing, and suddenly I can get like a whole Lee glove. You know, I'm not entirely
sure. Do you
have
to, go? What do you, how do you get those things made?
I need to see how you actually send this stuff in.
Do you
in.
Chop your finger off and mail it in? And they
just mail it back to me. It's cool.
But are they collecting a database of fingerprints? Or do they? How do they get your fingerprints?
And that's some other questions, too, is for them to make this, I would assume that they're going to have the fingerprints. That gets into a lot of other things, too. It's a company called Nanotips. So, yeah.
So you,
oh, okay, so actually this is good. This actually looks like, okay, so this is the first time I've actually seen this. So it looks like you get to make them at home. So you don't, like, chip off your fingerprint.
Oh, they send you a thing.
You get kits. But yeah. What this is you got a professional quality fingerprint cloner kit available to you for, like, you know, I'm sure, like, you know, not even, like, three easy payments. I'm sure one very hard payment.
But they have your credit card information, so they have your real name, so they have your fingerprint. They're collecting a physical database, and it probably has some DNA in there, too. When you send that thing off, it's not like, you know. So what's really going on here?
Don't know.
Don't you send them your fingerprints and let's find out.
Well, I mean, is it just for, it's for the actual fingerprint scanner part?
Yeah, it's just for mainly, well, I would assume you could use this at any biometric reader. The main thing is they've been able to make a very quick fingerprint cloning kit. You can then transfer to a glove or someone else's finger, you know, whatever. Who knows who's wearing the glove?
But I can give you my fingerprint so you can run to the office and get my notebook that I left.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, if I don't want to wake up, hey, man, go do this. Here. Bring my fingerprint.
Fingerprints aren't the only thing that the scanners use, though, because we've poked at it before on ours, and I know a bunch of other tech sites have, too. Like, you can unlock it with it's not just the fingerprint. There's some kind of, like, bioelectrical thing that, like, works with the fingerprint, although presumably that comes up through your gloves.
Oh, you mean to where it thinks that it actually has human flesh behind it,
well,
or
like,
does the resistance capacitance right
if
ratio?
If you happen to have a banana on you right now, for example.
Oh, hey!
An actual banana, and you take the banana peel and hold it over the fingerprint scanner and then, like, try to unlock it through your fingerprint scanner, it'll still unlock.
Banana phone.
Yes, thank you.
Ring, ring, ring.
And so it's more than just like the ridge and groove pattern on your finger that does it. It's like a whole thing. But presumably they found a way to trap your essence inside of those fingerprints, and they rip your soul out, and that's how it works. Scary. Magical.
We will have to try this out.
That's
maybe
different from just like the regular capacitive gloves that you can get where you can use touchscreen.
Yeah,
right?
Because that just more or less, those gloves just, some of them don't work all that well, but they you know, pretend to make touching and moving around your, you know, unlocking your phone very easy.
Oh,
otherwise,
is that a,
it's
is that
very
a Pixel?
Large. Yeah,
oh,
yeah, we missed that. I had this. Well, no, I had it. I think it's the third show I've had it.
Okay.
But yeah, it's the Pixel X.
Well, they make those gloves that have the little beads on them so you can actually operate touchscreens.
Oh, yeah.
Which are pretty nifty, like when you're trying to be out in the cold and not wanting to expose your flesh to the raw biting wind of winter, which we don't know much about here. That's right. Last week, so it was you and Groovehouse and Afflicted and Pete and Dwight.
Mm-hmm.
How'd
all
that
in
go?
The studio.
Yeah?
Yeah, went well. We went out. We had dinner together. You know?
Did you go to Taco Trucks?
No, we went to
those
some new
coming.
Joint right down the way.
No more Taco Trucks.
Yeah, somewhere on Montrose.
Yeah.
Cool.
Before or after the show?
Before. Wow. Yeah, everyone's old. Everyone left here after the show.
Was Dwight
much.
Excited to be back?
Yeah,
he was, you know, I listened to a little bit of it. He was amazed by the show prep and by having any structure, which is gone now because Pete's not here. Pete did
it's
mention
the backbone
this, and that's
of everything.
Mostly me.
Yeah.
Yeah, he takes care of that
stuff.
There's
no mostly about it.
Ah.
Good for Dwight. I hope he's Hope he's listening right now, making fun of us.
He's not. He's playing with his cats.
He is.
He's trying to get the last bit of joy out of Vine before they shut their doors.
So, all right, speaking of playing with stuff.
Okay.
No, this is not dirty. This is not a dirty kind of playing with stuff. I started messing with, I guess this is mainly something that Barrett and Inflicted would care about. Jay, I don't think you're going to care.
I don't care already.
I've started messing with using containerized virtual machines on my little Ubuntu box at home. I have like a little mishmash of little closet servers that I do stuff with, and I wanted to redo one of them, but like, because I put Ubuntu 16.04 on them, and Ubuntu 16.04 switches from Upstart Jobs to systemd, and it, like, everything was broken and horrible, and I wanted to like wipe one of them and like start from scratch and clean the cruft off. And the way I decided to do it was to set up Ubuntu has this customized, maybe it's not customized, Ubuntu has a thing called LXD, which is a front end to LXC, which is a containerized VM. It's like a step beyond Docker. It's actually supposed to be machine level instead of app level. So I took one of my boxes that had a bunch of services on it, Bind9 and ISC, DHCPD basically, and my Mumble server, and like one of the ones that I wanted to wipe. And I migrated, I spun up a quick little LXC virtual machine and migrated all my stuff into it. And it works great. If you haven't messed, if you're like thinking about like, if you're running Linux at home, specifically Ubuntu, and you wanna, and you're thinking about doing something with virtualization, or just want like a project to hack on, like standing up these LXC containers and migrating services into them is like actually really, really cool. Because at first I was like, all right, I guess I got to install, you know, Xen or KVM, and you got to like figure out how to set that up, and it's a pain in the butt. But before I went down that road, I started screwing with LXC, and it turned out to be like actually really, really, really cool. So if either of you are you know, lame enough to be running Ubuntu at home and not, you know, I don't know what version of Linux you favor, you're probably a CentOS guy, and I think Flicked has said he's a Debian fellow, but if you happen to have Ubuntu handy, I would start messing with it. It was really neat. So that grew from like 2 weeks ago starting out with like one, to where now I've like containerized all of my stuff. So I've containerized my mail server, I've containerized my web stuff. I've got an internal services box running Bind and DHCPD, and you know, now I have like all these little like new little tiny, and plus they migrate. So you can have two servers you can have two Ubuntu servers each running LXD, and you can live migrate the containers between them, just like vMotion, like in the real world, but with a little container, and it like skips it back, and there's a little bit of a service interruption. It's not quite like vMotion.
Completely instantaneous.
It's not like the vMotion that you pay millions of dollars for, but it's really good for free. So highly recommended. Go download containerize your applications today. All right, that was kind of a lame little thing, but you know what? It was fun.
Are there open containerized laws?
Yes, they're open. You have to be careful. You can have the container, but it has to be in a paper bag when you're walking with it, because of the law. No, it doesn't really. There's no paper bag.
There is and there isn't.
The paper bag is in your mind. It was the paper bag. It was with you all along.
So you went out of town last week. Was that anything good?
I did. I went to I was in New York, which sounds a lot more glamorous than it actually was, because I got to see the Newark airport, and I got to see the hotel, and I got to see the 35th and 36th floor of One World Trade, where the Condé Nast offices were, and that was the extent of my, and we saw a couple of restaurants, and that was the extent of my New York experience. Laura had a great time. Laura met up with a friend who had moved to the city many, many years ago, and the two of them went out and, I don't know, did girl stuff together, got their nails done or something. They walked around a lot. Laura said she walked the Brooklyn Bridge and went to the New York Public Library and saw all kinds of fancy stuff. I saw the hotel back and forth. It was like a, you know, business trips always end up being like that. Like, it sounds like you're going to go to some faraway, fun, exciting place, and it's like, but once you're there, you have precisely enough time to, like, wake up and go to meetings and then, like,
I've had to have been
eat
about
a lame
as interesting
dinner.
As my trip to Troy, Michigan.
Honestly, the best part was the flight, because the flight ended up being on a big jet. It was on a 767, and I had enough points to upgrade us, so we were in, like, pods in the front of the jet for the flight there and the flight back. And I guess when, like, the first class flight to and from your destination was the most interesting part of the trip, that it's kind of a lame trip. It was pretty cool, though. The seats laid back all the way flat, and you could, it was neat.
How long was it a flight to New York?
That's like 3 hours. It wasn't long enough to, like, really need the lay flat seats, but it was neat to have them just to be like, look, I'm laying down. Oh, I'm sitting up.
I'm not even tired.
Yeah.
But you can't lay down.
Turn around and yell to the back of the plane, look what I'm doing, peasants. Look what you can't do.
What do you got, Barry?
Well, we talked about, I think, Hue lights recently, too. That might have been last week.
Yeah,
you touched on it a couple times.
I have some. I like them.
So, yeah, so there's have you heard about and I don't know the security researcher's name, but they've been flying around a drone, more or less taking over Zigbee networks.
Oh, awesome.
Through some backdoor stuff. So what I did not know is I actually went to their page, and so more or less, if they get within
I believe it, too, because Zigbee is ancient.
Oh, it is, yeah, and it's open. It's got a lot of issues. We won't even get into them right now because we've got about 8 minutes, but they took a drone, if anything, within about 700 meters, and that's mm-hmm. pretty long range, they were able to get it flashing SOS, more or less.
That's funny.
Which is pretty cool. So, and more or less, that's a not a passive attack, but that's like a straight up attack. You've got to have presence. You've got to be in the control mm-hmm. thing to take over the lights and have them bend to your will.
Well, supposedly though, the Hue communication is supposed to be reasonably secure. It's over Zigbee, mm-hmm. but it's
so
HTTP.
Break this down a little bit for those that don't know
okay.
what the heck
well,
you're talking
so we're
about.
Talking about like intelligent lights. So there's a number of wireless communication signals, and really what you get
so
into.
So these are lights in a smart home situation, yeah, the Internet of Things, where you have lights that can be controlled by another device to change the color.
Well, think like you've got Wi-Fi. This is just another wireless connectivity way to talk, only it doesn't need to get a lot of information. You're not doing videos. You're doing little bitty packets of information, and it needs to be low energy, and it doesn't have to go very far. It's all inside the house. Yeah. So, and they never really thought that anyone else would ever, I guess maybe they never thought they would sell enough units to where they get the saturation that they do, or maybe that anyone would ever attack this stuff, or anyone would ever like sniff with some wireless gear and see what's actually going on. But there are a lot of ways to attack it. So the scary thing, so I knew that you could get in there and, take over some lights if you had presence with them. What they're looking at now is they've actually got a worm to where if they can find, now they've got to have some density, but if they can find like a city with a little bit more than 15,000 randomly located smart lights, they can drop a worm that propagates through the entire light system and actually would control the entire city light system with like a single drop-in point with the right density. Because a lot of the attack is based on them exercising and blowing past some address space and going into some, like having over X amount of devices. But this looks very legit. We just need to
now,
go
these
find
are lights, these lights, the Zigbee thing you're talking
about. So the Zigbee
about.
Lights, so they could also be, now they're not just home lights, they could be traffic lights in a city, they could be street lights. A lot of cities and municipalities are like putting in these, instead of running hard wire, they'll just, run, you do it two ways. You could either run like GPRS, modem things and have to pay a cellular contract and do all this power stuff. They are addressable, but it's expensive. Or maybe you have one modem, like in this, one little area, and then within that modem you have all these Zigbee connections that can reach that modem, and you send one connection to the main modem, and then they cannot communicate Zigbee through all the others. So
what's the worst
Zigbee's
thing
a mesh networking thing. So the idea is that, if I can't maybe, if you could see how we're sitting in the studio, it goes me, Lee, Jay. I can't maybe reach Jay, but I could, hit Lee on the arm, Lee hits Jay, and it goes back that way. So that's mesh networking. That's kind of whatever it is. So... No JLEs were actually harmed during that demonstration.
Are there traffic lights that are being run by this?
Yeah, I think there are. I don't know if there are any.
Most are GPRS, but
But there are. They're trying to just cut some costs and stuff like that. You've got to have density, but they're starting to.
So this is another thing like where they had the man in the middle attacks, where they had smart registers or cash registers connected to a Wi-Fi network that talked back to a computer,
or
the gas box would talk to the store. People would jump on that Wi-Fi and intercept credit card data. So they create it. They don't think anybody's going to be like, they're not building it with the idea that it can be exploited, mm-hmm. Because security through obscurity, who even knows? But then somebody figures it out, and it's, oh my God, we're all going to die.
Well, yeah, the issue is, too, is that, like, the Zigbee stuff, it's a protocol, and you can buy just a Zigbee chip, and it's very cheap. So what a lot of people will do is they will package Zigbee into their whatever hardware they're making, and it's got, like, you know, like programs do, like an application program interface, like a little interface that says, hey, if you want to do this, say this. If you want to do this, say this. It's got the same thing, but with hardware, usually it's just a serial line. So the thing is, you know, a lot, it gets recycled into a lot of products without the people who are building these products necessarily knowing what security issues it has. They just look at the spec sheet. Oh, it'll do this. It'll do this. Okay, this power consumption will go this far. This is perfect. Let's use this. But then, you know, when you find that security flaw in Zigbee, it affects every single application, every single device that Zigbee was used in. So it gets really far-reaching really quickly.
But I need my Hue lights, though. Gotta
I do.
Have them.
Well, what else competes with Zigbee right now? Like maybe Bluetooth Low Energy? Maybe. I know there's one other thing.
Decked, basically. Yeah. It's like, that's kind of there. Isn't there? Isn't
you get into some SCADA stuff? But I mean, for cheap home use,
X10 is X10 a transport? I don't even remember. But yeah, I mean, that's Zigbee. I think is one you can use with minimal royalties, and that's one that's widely adopted. And that's the thing. I mean, you've got to have. That's like to get your home of the future working. All of your stuff has to be interconnected at some point, and either you take like the Apple HomeKit route or the Google Home route, where you have like all of your devices speak separate stuff, but they speak to an offsite service that then communicates back to the devices over their same thing, and your coordination takes place outside your house, giving you a massive vulnerability center there. Or they speak locally over a compromised protocol, and your vulnerability is inside your house. It's like, where would you like your vulnerability to be? It could be out or in. Wherever you'd like your vulnerability to be.
Can I have both?
You could have both if you want. Sure, absolutely. It's just a question of, like, where you want the hole to be.
It's going to get fun. So it's really interesting in light of that large, you know, distributed denial of service attack that we had, that a lot of, you know, we thought a lot of the traffic was coming from cameras and things like that that are also connected but don't have, you know, off-the-shelf antivirus packages immediately available for them.
Yep.
It's fun.
Yeah. Well, just don't put anything on the internet. Don't look at the internet. Stay away from the internet. The internet's terrible. It's going to break all your stuff.
Should we just power the internet down now?
Turn the internet off, flip the switch on it, and run away. Mm-hmm. Throw your computer away, live in caves.
Permission denied. I can't shut down the internet.
You have to. You have to shut it down. Flicked, how's it going in the booth in there? We're running out of stuff to talk about. Is it almost time for a break?
Yeah, y'all just need to cover, you know, about 30 more seconds.
Oh, all right.
We can cover 30 seconds talking about 30 seconds.
Yeah, how long is 30 seconds?
Well, it's one, two.
23 seconds longer than a Cure album.
How long is that in milliseconds?
23 seconds longer than a Cure album?
That was the name of the Cure
seconds.
Album. 17, no, I did my math wrong. I'm sorry. Kill off a 10.
So that's what I was queuing on. Not.
I'm doing journalism math because White was here last week.
We don't want to be showing off too many fancy math skills.
Oh, no.
Because it might draw unwanted attention from the new overlords. All right. So, you know, we're still on the air. Thank goodness for that. You've been listening to Technology Bites. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back after these messages. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Plicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm confused.
And he's?
Yeah.
Groovehouse.
There he is.
Mark your calendar for the 11th annual Via Colori Street Painting Festival, Saturday, November 19th and Sunday, November 20th in downtown Houston. Watch as more than 200 artists paint our city streets. Stay for live music on three stages, including the Mighty Ork, Colonial Blue, and American Idol contestant Jess Muse. Enjoy fun activities for all ages and sample delicious food from local food trucks. Via Calori benefits the Center for Hearing and Speech, a local nonprofit whose mission is to help children with hearing loss learn to listen, speak, and read. Don't miss the Via Calori Street Painting Festival November 19th and 20th in downtown Houston. For details and to purchase tickets, visit HoustonViaCalori.com. Presented in part by KPFT Houston.
KPFT is seeking local organizations, businesses, and individuals to take part in our Community Partner Program. Community partners help KPFT through supporting initiatives of the station, reducing our pledge drives, and being key contributors to our success. As a community partner, your organization or business becomes invested in a richer way in KPFT. You help keep important independent radio flowing. Interested in being a community partner? Contact Development Director Robin Lewis anytime. Just call 713-526-4000 or just send an email to robin@kpft.org. Thanks for your interest in our Community Partners Program. This is KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, and at this point in time, I will turn the reins back over to Jay Lee and the boys.
The Bears. All right, how about that sports ball?
The Bears.
That was actually, though, I mean, my week of contrast was two nights of staying up late and watching something really nail-biting, but the good one was the Cubs. I actually enjoyed watching Game 7 of the World Series.
That's football, right?
It is. You know, the game where they...
I was able to watch the end of it because of the rain delay.
Oh, yeah? Were you at work?
No, I was at the radio station.
Why don't they play in the rain?
Oh, right.
That seems lame.
Well, they will play if it's raining a little bit, but once...
There's a pretty good size
really
storm
slick,
coming their way.
So?
Or if there's, like, lightning that could hit the light poles and
wouldn't
stuff.
Wouldn't that just make it even more entertaining, though?
Maybe for people who don't like the people that are at the stadium.
You want... I mean, you're talking about entertaining because as an observer of people being struck by lightning.
People
who
are
struck by
Westworld.
Lightning don't find it as entertaining.
Yeah. Maybe you should watch less Westworld.
Maybe I should. I don't know. Maybe. I think they should play in the rain. We've launched rockets in the rain, man. Although not actually the last time we launched a rocket in the rain. It worked out very, very badly. It was almost a bad thing.
Almost?
It's almost a bad thing. That was Apollo 12 was the last time they launched a rocket into a thunderstorm, and it almost didn't work out.
Let's rethink our mission plan.
Ended up working out.
Well, that's good.
They didn't know any better. Maybe that's why they don't play baseball in the rain, because they realized that maybe lightning's bad.
Take out one of our rockets.
Could be.
One of the home team.
It ended up working out okay, though. They got up to orbit and stuff.
So I don't. Do you guys take the local paper? It looks like Samsung took out full page ads in several papers, including the Wall Street Journal, New York Times,
say,
the Washington
we're sorry.
Post. More or less apologizing for the Note 7 defects.
Oh man, I can tell you when. So speaking of the Note 7, yeah, on the plane ride last week.
Oh, they're
week,
announcing on all the flights.
They did.
Last
they
time
totally
I flied,
did.
So
yeah, but you know what
there.
Bothers me about that is that they say it's not allowed, but they don't check.
No, they don't check, but they were, I mean, that's the cover their butt announcement, so that if you are the guy who still has the Note 7 and brings it on the plane and it blows
up,
we
all die, we know who to blame.
It's your fault. But yeah, they explicitly called it out. And it wasn't just like, hey, if you have a Note 7, please turn it off. They like spent like 30, 40 seconds on like, due to recent product recalls.
I flew on Delta to go to Michigan, and they said there are no Note 7s allowed on this plane.
Yeah.
But, you know, they check that the same way they check to make sure everybody puts their phones into airplane mode,
which is not, which is at, not all. At all.
It's a Note 6, like they would know.
Yeah. I mean, come on. I wouldn't know. I'd be like, it's a big Samsung
I was
Samsung
looking around.
Thing.
I saw Samsungs, and I was like, that might be a 7. Should I say something? See something? Say something.
Mm-hmm. If you don't turn in people who have Samsung phones, you're flying with Hitler.
He had a Samsung launcher on his phone. I saw that.
Well, TouchWiz is pretty ugly. I think they're still going to keep it, though. They're still going to keep TouchWiz, even though TouchWiz is probably what was blowing up all those phones.
Isn't that what was causing the fires?
I'm pretty sure that's what was actually causing the fire.
No.
Okay.
It's just their skin, the Samsung skin. It's so horribly ugly and sad. That's
I'm
like
pure
straight
Android again.
Pure
yeah,
Android.
No, I did carry the Edge for a while, which was a little Samsung phone, but I'm back to pure Android.
How's it feel?
It's nice.
Pure
I mean, it's,
again.
I like that I finally get to carry an iPhone.
Yeah.
More or less.
The camera's supposed to be really good on
camera's really good, and I've totally gotten accustomed to unlocking it in the back, gestures on the back camera.
Is that how that works?
It all kinds of different configurations.
Oh, that's
kind of
cool.
Yeah, so, you know, I've got it where it locks out immediately. If you want to get anything, you've got to hit, you know, codes or whatever, or just boom on the back and unlocks immediately, which is nice. Now, I do know this is kind of weird. If you, like, you coming out of the shower, I think if your fingerprints are a little bit off or, like, enlarged, it won't work.
Really?
What are you using your phone in the shower for?
No. I mean, like, put on the shower.
Why not?
No, not in the shower.
Right after getting out of the shower.
Like, I might get out, work call, get out of the shower, try and unlock my phone. Like, hands dry, dried off in a towel. Within, like, you know, a minute or two being dry, like, the fingerprints, I guess, are off enough because of the swelling
in
the water.
Some Instagram pics.
Yeah. Snap, snap, snap. Mm. Snap, snap, snap. No. No one wants
to
see that.
I've never tried that with iOS. I've never tried to see if the shower affects the unlock. Now I kind of want to do that.
So you may find yourself.
Excuse me, everybody.
You may find yourself taking an unexpected shower. I'll be right back, honey. I have to do some tech experiments.
I have to work in the shower.
With my phone. I'm going to take a shower. Where's my phone?
No, I don't have the waterproof iPhone. I'd have to wait till afterwards. And then pick it up and paw all over it.
Speaking of iPhones, isn't there a story coming out?
Well, I'm working on it. I write slow these days. I've failed upward into management at work, so it's a rare week when I get a story out. What I'm finding is that when you're a manager, people try to talk to you all day long. Like all day long. Like, you can't do anything. You sit there and like
because of meetings or people that are under you?
Both.
Or it's at your level.
There's
or
meetings, there's mostly it's like since I'm on the site editorial board, so I have basically half of the site is my overall responsibility. So I have section editors that report to me, and they have writers that report to them. But like, there are, I mean, probably I get, I don't know, I can pull the stats up. I can pull up the Slack stats and actually look and see. But I probably get 300 or 400 IMs a day from various people just asking just little procedural questions like, hey, should I write about this? Or, hey, I talked to so-and-so, and he said I should do this, and what's your take on it? Or can you help me out with a headline? Or, you know, can you, like, approve my expense report? Or can you tell me what the thing is to get to the expense report? Or did you see my expense report?
Did arbitrator? Like, man, so-and-so's been a real jerk. Like, can you talk to him? And
usually not, but because that's like, because I don't have any actual like power like that. That has to go to the real boss, the EIC who does all of that. But I mean, there's just a lot of dealing with everybody's little, you know, quirks and BS all day long. Like, it's, you know, just people like one of the folks who works for me, and I want to say this very diplomatically because he may or may not be listening, is a let's see, what's the best way to put this? He works best when he receives constant feedback.
Is he meticulous?
He can be very meticulous. He's a very good writer, but he works best when he can bounce ideas off of people kind of constant. Like, his creative process involves like
interaction.
And he not necessarily likes to be micromanaged, because that's not really the right term. But he has a very difficult time executing an idea unless he can, like, talk through it with somebody. And, like, if you're at the computer at the wrong time and he IMs you and he sees that you're online, that person is going to be you. And
so this is sort of related, but not exactly, because it's people's working styles. Mm. You know, and so I've worked over the years with some people that are very, like, shoot from the hip, right? I worked with a guy. It was hilarious. I worked with a guy who was he wanted things to happen. He wanted to get it done, and he wanted to move on. That was, everything was about that, which is great when everything's slow, right? And he's like pushing stuff along. But at the same time, he wouldn't think things through when there were more complex scenarios. And so he was at the same level as another guy I worked with who was not fast like that. He wasn't like super slow, being meticulous, but he liked to think things through before he made a decision. But he was one of those guys who would bounce ideas off as he was thinking about it to try to find holes in it to find the best solution. And when they worked together, it was like the IT Laurel and Hardy. It was it was hilarious because we're sitting there, you know, doing some like system upgrade of like a whole bunch of servers. And we run into some problem because somebody brought a system down that had a file share that actually had a file that was supposed to be shared out to all the systems. Like, oh man, now we're in this catch 22. Like, this system's already down, but we need this file. What should we do? And so the you know, the fast moving guy, he's getting impatient, sitting at the key, and he's sitting at the keyboard. And so the guy who's, you know, more meticulous, he's trying to kind of bounce ideas to come up with solutions. He's like, well, maybe we could do this and do it this way. And the other guy's like, oh yeah, that's a good idea.
Starts typing.
Yeah, and he's like, whoa, just a second. I'm not sure they already did it.
but
that's going to like cause it to boot up, and it's not going to do it, and it's going to bring others to, oh man, other systems are crashing.
Yeah.
That's what's going to, okay, crap, now what do we do? Okay, well, we could do, no, already did it.
Like, but wait.
And that it was like, come on, dude, just stop and listen to me and talk. He's like, no, man, I want to solve problems.
Yeah, yes. I've had those kinds of sysadmin moments myself, too.
I worked with some other people, not directly, but, you know, I've also worked with some people who are, maybe a bit of it is that they're scared of, like, making a mistake and doing something wrong and causing a problem, right? So they're kind of gun-shy about stuff. And the thing is, even if they think about it a long time, they still don't want to do it. They want somebody else to make that decision. But if you give them things to do, like steps to follow, I mean, they're just like going through it. Like, it's just, oh yeah, fine. You gave me these steps to do. Yeah, I did it. I did the steps to do. Okay, what next?
Really don't want that responsibility, even whatever that responsibility happens to be.
Which, you know, and so usually those people end up like in an operational role versus an engineering role. But, which is good. I mean, you need people to do that sort of stuff. But we had this one group of people who weren't necessarily super tech savvy, and they were AV guys, and you know they knew that they're
gotta have AV guys.
They knew their AV gear.
They make the world go round.
But we had this procedure where they needed to, once they recorded some stuff, they needed to put it up onto servers, video servers, to make it available, you know, to the general public that was consuming the videos. And so one day they called up and they said, hey man, this isn't working anymore. We can't put the videos. Something's wrong. I'm like, oh no, man, you go look at the server. Well, the server's still up. I'm gonna look at the FTP server process. No, it's still running. Okay, well, let me test it. Okay, I got the prompt. Okay, I logged in. I'm in the right directory. Okay, let me try uploading a file. Okay, uploaded a file. Okay, what's going on? It doesn't work. It's not working. Well, what's not working? Well, you know, we did, because we had upgraded the software, right? The software was old. It wasn't being updated anymore. It had been abandoned, and so we switched over to a new piece of software for FTP. But the functionality was all still there and working. So finally we start talking to him, like, hey, because what's going on? Like, what's the problem? It turns out what the deal was is at their desk, where they sat down in front of their computer, they had a sheet of paper that said, here's the steps to do to upload files. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Yeah.
You know, one is, you know, open the FTP program. Two is type in this IP address for the server, name for the server. Three is you get the prompt, username, type in your account. That's where they got hung up, because when they got to that point, it said login instead of username, and they couldn't get past that.
Oh, because it wasn't the... Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to some people, the computer really is like a you know, a magic scary devil box. And some people really are like very, very much rote computer users.
Yep.
It's very much a thing. All right, I'll tell my worst IT story ever here. This is now, since it's kind of a slow night, this is kind of a good place for it. You reminded me of it with that story. So I I rolled in one day. This is at this was at Boeing, where I used to be when I was on the enterprise architecture side. This here in Houston. I rolled in one day, and we had had for a long time. We had our operations stuff was outsourced to a three-letter agency, whose name I will not repeat to protect the innocent and the guilty. And we had an opening that we had been waiting to be filled for quite some time for an HPUX admin, because HPUX is, you know, it's kind of a complicated operating system.
It's its own little thing.
Yeah, and it requires special knowledge. And if you have, you know, we had, I think it was, we didn't have a full super dome. I think we had a half dome, but we, you know, we had HPUX boxes that we needed work on, and our HPUX guy had departed. So, you know, when you have your operations are sourced, you kind of put in the request and, you know, pull handle, and eventually, like, you know, a new HPUX person is distributed to you. And so I rolled in one morning, and our new HPUX person had showed up, and everybody was really excited. And I walked in, and the way I walked in to get to my desk, I walked through the data center because it was faster than going through the side hallway. And, you know, I saw a new guy there, and he was kind of in a group with a bunch of other people, all the other admins, and it was kind of being introduced. And I walked up and shook his hand, and, you know, I was like, oh, hey, how are you doing? And he told me his name, and I immediately forgot his name because that's how I roll. And, you know, he introduced himself and said he was our new HPUX guy. And when I shook his hand was, like, really sweaty. But I thought, I don't know, some people have sweaty hands, you know, whatever. And, you know, I kind of made a joke like, hey, you know, looking forward to working with you. You've got a lot of stuff lined up, because we had like a bunch of work that had kind of been queued. And, you know, it's kind of smiled, and I walked off to my desk.
And he said, kind of. Okay, good.
And so I walked off to my desk, and, you know, got plowed through the morning email and da 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 da. And I got to the point to where I kind of needed, like, I was the SAN administrator, and we had some, doing SAN allocations with EMC Symmetrics and HPUX is very complicated. You have to do volume set addressing, and it's this really stupid thing because HPUX kind of is just really dumb. And so I was kind of to the point in my day where I was like, all right, now would be a good time to go circle up with this guy and kind of see what his schedule is like and talk about, like, can we do this? And it's been like 2 or 3 hours, you know, it's before lunch still, but it's still morning. So I stick my, and I didn't want to just walk up and be like, because I'd forgotten his name. I didn't want to be like, hey,
dude.
Guy. So I poked my head into my neighbor's cube, and I was like, hey, Tim, I need to go talk to, you know, the new dude about stuff. Do you remember his name so that I can walk up and, you know, not be like an idiot? And Tim's like, oh, he's gone. And I was like, he's out like having a smoke, or and Tim's like, no, he's like gone. And I was like, what happened? And he goes, well, so like, apparently, after he got introduced to everybody, we started like telling him like, we're, you know, we need you here for the morning status meeting in about 30 minutes, and we're going to go over your workload, and he got really freaked out, and left. And so we went to the other contractors and asked where he was. And the other contractors said that when he showed up in the morning, the first thing he said when he walked in was like, oh man, I'm so excited to be here on this. This is going to be easy street. This is this big government contract with, like, you guys don't have to do any work here from what I've heard. It's all just like lay back and get that government contract money. And he admitted that he had like totally fabricated like the vast majority of his, he had no HPUX experience, had never seen a Superdome before, had no idea how HPUX worked. So once the seriousness of the morning's events settled on him, like, yeah, like, not only do we have work for you to do, we like literally need you to do this, like, start today, and in 30 minutes we're gonna have the meeting where we drop all of this work on you. He like literally walked out to his car, drove away, and called his contracting agency boss and quit over the phone.
Wow.
while frantically speeding down the road away from the office. So we did end up eventually getting an HPUX person. It took a few more weeks for them to find somebody who actually was qualified. But that was like, that is the most blatant, like, insanity thing that I think that's ever happened to me at work.
This is not quite that good, because it's not quite that fast.
It was
but
so
it's,
crazy.
But it's good in a different way. So at my previous job, a few years ago, because one of the managers was getting super excited about cloud. Everything was cloud, right? So he created a cloud initiative position, and a few people got interviewed, and we ended up hiring this guy, and he showed up, and he was...
I never heard of the cloud before.
He was there the first day, and he was there the second day, and I think the third day he was there part of the day, and then the fourth day, I'm not sure he was there at all the whole day, and maybe he came in on Friday a little bit, and then
he was busy researching the cloud.
The next week, he just wasn't there, and so everybody's kind of like, what happened? Like, he was here for a couple days, and then he was kind of here a couple days, and then now he's not even there, and it turned out evidently what had happened is this guy thought this job sounded pretty interesting, but he already had a job, and he didn't want to give it up if this job wasn't cool. So he accepted this job offer and took some sick days from his other job without quitting.
Brilliant.
Came to the job, tried it out for a while, but then he had to start coming back to his other job because he couldn't just be out for days and days. And he decided, you know what, I don't think I want that job after all. So he just kept working at his other place.
That's genius. That's how you get yourself blacklisted. Never being hired anywhere ever again. Ugh. Never had that happen. We did have an admin at a past job work remotely, and we found out that he was working remotely because he was working somewhere else at a different company at the same time, drawing double paychecks. That was great.
I've heard those stories before. I haven't known that to happen, but I've had.
You can.
Heard those
I mean,
stories.
Apparently, it's not that uncommon. You just have to figure out. You have to figure out a way where you can work it right, where like both jobs are remote, and like maybe it's like an operations role or an architecture role where you don't have to like constantly be doing stuff, and you can just kind of fit like the two jobs in. Because every job has especially if it's like an admin job, you know, you'll have. And I can say this confidently, having done sysadmin work for many, many years, there'll be weeks sometimes where it's just like, well, how much Reddit can I browse through today? You know, you do 20 minutes of work and 7 hours and 40 minutes of not work. It happens. And that's when you can work on your other job, I guess. Of course, then you have other times where it's like, this not working 80 hours a week for the next 4 weeks because we're doing a big transition or a big new stand-up of something.
Or something blew up.
Yeah, something blew up. Something blew up at 4 a.m, and guess where I'm going to be for the next 2 weeks, rebuilding the RAID array and restoring all those backup tapes. Ugh, and now I have PTSD. Because the backup tapes were bad, and it goes from there.
That's so horrible when that happens.
Because Iron Mountain lied about the backup tapes. Yeah.
They stuck them next to the magnets.
Yeah, the backup tapes look okay.
Next to the backup magnets.
Until you're on the 800th tape, and the 800th tape in your tape set, unfortunately, has a problem.
I hadn't thought of those in a while. Remember those like the electromagnet erasers that had the handle with the push button to turn
them,
and you
big portable degaussers.
Yeah. Wipe the tapes.
It's fun stuff.
I had forgotten about those things.
Those were cool. You had to be careful and segregate those in your data center away from your actual tapes that you cared about. Don't use them in the one room. Use them in the other room. Oh, yeah. Backup tapes. That's something I haven't had to deal with in forever, and I'm so glad. Did you ever see one of, like, a truly, truly monster tape robot library?
We had UPS had silos, like, literally.
Yeah.
Like, rows and rows of silos. Each tape machine, 12 rows of like maybe 65 around to do the math, and it was like literally there'd be
robots.
Two arms going inside and retrieving tapes for backup and moving them out and recycling everything, and it was pretty
cool. I saw those, but I was never responsible for them. So like in my first admin job, I was responsible for about 8 to 10 Solaris systems, and on most of them we used local backup tapes, and so I would have to start backup jobs every night before I left work, or at least put the tapes in so that the cron jobs could kick off to do the backups at night. On a couple of them, we had more disks in them, so we had, what was that, exabyte mammoth autoloaders. Like it was seven, so it was like a curved thing with seven tapes in it, so it was like a baby version of the big ones. But when I got to my next job, somebody was doing backups. And eventually that person moved into security, so there was an opening for backups. And my manager came to me and was like, hey, Terry, you know, we got a position open for backup stuff. You know, are you want to do that? No, I do not want to do that.
You'd really don't.
So since that time, I've successfully avoided ever being responsible for any kind of like backup system.
I don't know what a lot of modern shops are doing anymore. We had at Boeing, we had big STK storage tech libraries that were so like the, they weren't the round ones. They were the rectangular, like long ones. And they were so big. They had to have fire suppression plumbed into the top of them because the data center fire suppression wouldn't like go inside of them. But it's all, I mean, I guess companies now are just doing, they're buying disk stuff. They're doing whatever current data domain is or data domain's competitors. They've got to be all doing libraries now.
Yeah, a lot of them are going, from what I've seen, I mean, there's still some to tape, to offsite for some things.
Yeah.
But a lot of stuff, yeah, they're going to, they have a ton of spinning drives in some NAS, a lot of SAN, but then on the like NetApp, a lot of people use NetApp or maybe Hitachi storage or whatever, but they'll have everything go to that, and then they'll doing snap mirrors live, so they'll have like nearline storage, and then even from there, that'll be sitting there live spinning in case they need something, and then after a certain number of hours or days or whatever, then it'll go to like third tier storage, which is older, bigger disks that don't spin as fast. That they can shove a bunch of stuff to, but it's still disks. It's still not the tape. And then some stuff, if it's important enough, they'll write off the tape and then take off site. That's kind of what I've seen a lot of companies go into.
It's wild. I don't ever want to do that again. I don't ever want to have to go back to doing IT operations. That would make me sad. I like my ivory journalism tower now, where I just get to sit at home and write about it.
Apparently, you're not doing that anymore.
No, I don't even have to do that anymore. I just sit at home and manage the people who are writing about it.
He just reads Reddit.
That's what I do all day long.
I just saw a great story on Reddit. Find it, know what I mean, write about it.
Yeah, just write that. Just write that writer person.
You could just see if you could like just take a Reddit thread and like copy and paste comments out enough comments out of a Reddit thread to where you can actually get an article.
Top 20 things that happen to waiters. It's BuzzFeed all
and
out
Mashable and those guys. Yeah, a lot of them, and like a lot of them will even start the thread. Like they'll spin up an alt account and they'll go to Reddit. They'll be like, "What's the craziest cat IT story you've ever heard?" And like they'll like then take like the 300 responses and package that, and that's the article they'll run.
I only watched one episode, and I was hopeful because it had Stephen Fry and one of the characters from Community in it. It's called The Great Outdoors, and it's a sitcom. And basically, it's a magazine that writes about camping and hiking and outdoors. And they got this one guy who goes out and actually does it all.
This was like the social media show.
And
people
now they're going to an online presence. Social media, so they got a bunch of millennials and that are running the place, and it's that whole BuzzFeed kind of thing where they're just putting together what do you need for a zombie attack out of all of this camping gear that would be useful, like an ice pick or whatever. But it was really great. They pulled up the guy, obviously it's these these social media savvy millennials. And then the dinosaur guy who actually goes out and does stuff and is active in the world. And they pull up his website. They find his website, and it's got the dancing baby on it. and the dancing baby, they said about the dancing baby, "Hey, dude, that baby's old enough now to have its own baby." man, this show is not good for me because I don't like the millennials, and I like the dancing baby.
Man, I think it is. I think the baby is old enough to have its own baby.
It is, because I know that I've Allie been, McBean. You know, what, 90...
something.
94, 95?
I don't think it was that
97,
old.
97. So it's still going to be 19 years old, though.
Dancing baby.
It's 97.
Yep, sure enough, the dancing baby has a Wikipedia article. The Dancing Baby, also called Baby Cha-Cha, is a 3D rendered animation of a baby dancing. It quickly became a media phenomenon and one of the first viral videos in the second half of the 1990s.
When it took 1.5 hours to download it to your computer so you could watch this 15-second Dancing Baby clip.
Autumn of 1996 is what it says here. Wow, there's like this. There's an exhaustive history of the Dancing Baby animation on Wikipedia if you're wanting to read it. Yeah, Ally McBeal. It was on Ally McBeal in 1997. This looks like what it says here. Yeah, this is definitely a Wikipedia article right here.
Is it? Can you tell?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like this is like kind of the typical Wikipedia article. It's an exhaustive article about an extremely trivial, extremely trivial subject.
The history of memes is weird because I've got, you know, there's a couple of guys that I work with, or they're not young. One's like in his 20s and one's in his 30s or something, but I guess that's young compared to me. Yeah. But it's weird talking to the next generation of nerds coming up who may not necessarily have the awareness of you know, we talk about in our day, you know, back, you know, 386, 286, you know, computers and stuff. But now, talking about in my day, Strong Bad.
You know, oh, yeah.
You know, meme-ish internet culture things that are not necessarily popular now, but were popular.
All your base,
yeah.
All your base.
Vintage memes. It's a thing. It makes you feel old.
Strong Bad is... I'm sad that that's, like, so old. Because that's, like... still totally popular and normal to me. Like Strong Bad is like totally like a normal thing to me still.
Although, you know, the Konami code has kind of passed through all the generations. Like it's not something dated necessarily. Like it's known.
Oh yeah, I remember my first encounter with the Konami code was shortly after we got our first Nintendo, which I guess would be in 87 or 88, something like that. Went down to the local Babbage's and picked up a couple of games, and one of them was Contra, and the guy behind the counter was like...
Did you go to the local Babbage's, or did you work at the local Babbage's?
Well, at the time, I was 10, so...
did you work at Babbage's?
Yeah.
Yeah, you grew up to work.
I did. I walked into my future workplace.
Someday, all this will be mine.
One day, in the back room, I will make out with my girlfriend and turn the security cameras off.
Shelves
Babbage's, you're not going to have a girlfriend?
Shelves and shelves of boxed software.
It'll be mine
that
one
can
day.
Never be returned. By any customer ever.
It's the future.
They had a good return policy.
Did they have a good return?
Oh, yeah. Babbage's had a great return policy.
You could buy software and take it home, install
days.
It on your computer, and bring it back and get your money
within
back?
Within 30 days. Your 30-day return policy forever and ever and
the
ever.
The original torrent.
They did that up until... It was 30 days until well after I started working there. And they went to 2 weeks after in 95 or 96. But it was still like, I mean, they could buy it and... open it up, install it, and if you didn't like it, bring it back.
I bought this lemonade stand game.
You know, surprisingly,
and
people...
It's inferior.
They kept track of, like, you know, if you did a return, there was, like, a form you had to fill out or whatever, and so they, you know, they kept track of who did returns, but, like, I can't remember, and I worked there, started working there in 1994 on my 16th birthday and worked there from 94 to 97. I can't remember anybody in the entire time I was there ever really like abusing the return policy, because it was so ridiculously generous that I think people got the fact that, like, you know, if you abuse this, this is going to go away. So don't. And it really helped. It's like with Steam now, which I'm glad Steam does returns now. It's like you no longer have to have that terror of like, I'm going to spend $60 on this stupid, you know, game or whatever. And if I don't like it, I'm stuck with this $60 thing that I can't do anything with. Although, I guess back in the day with physical software, you could always walk over to Walmart and try to get them to take it back. And 50% of the time, they'd be like, all right, whatever. Even if it didn't come from Walmart, they'd take it back and give you like $30 or $40 back for it. That was kind of like the secret weapon. It was like if you had, like, once the local Walmart started selling software, you could just return anything there. And they didn't care. They didn't know. It's like, whatever.
Well, the returns department of most places didn't know. I mean, I remember working at Best Buy, and I paid too much attention because I would actually open up. They would return a computer, and I'd open it up, and you find
there's
out
like nothing in it.
Find out that they had taken the case off of the 486 computer and shoved the chassis of a 386 computer in there and kind of put it back together as best they could, box it up, said, oh, this is no good, we don't want it.
It's a toaster.
Find all the memory pulled out of it, you know, or the processor gone, the CPU just gone.
Best Buy didn't care. They'd write that off. They just wanted you to be selling more extended warranties.
Yeah, but the beautiful story on that was, you know, I worked at Best Buy. It was my first tech job. And And I was, and I really just, I did not like the customers.
Selling PSPs, Jay.
Do not like those
people.
People coming in and taking advantage. I never liked people getting over. I was happy enough if people, you know, were interactive and we could share information. But the people that would come in and expect, you know, that they found this computer at this other store for a dollar less and we should match the price and it wasn't the exact specs because the store is new. They just basically, we get this version of the Packard Bell and Best Buy gets this version of the Packard Bell and one has, you know, slightly different processor speed or something. So it's not an exact match. So you couldn't do the price match. It was all a big scam. But later on, you know, so I was actually, when customers would come in, like they would buy a computer, screw it all up, come in, demand that we fix it, demand that we do this. And I got fed up with it and finally went off on one customer and got fired. And I was like,
oh, whoa, I want to hear all this one.
Well,
nice.
You know, so my boss pulled me into the office. And he says, you know, after I had this, the customer was trying to take advantage and was trying to rip us off, and I was trying to stop it, but not because I care about the store, just because.
At that point, it just made you angry.
I'm ornery. I'm just like, who do you think? You think I'm dumb? You know, I'm not.
Yeah.
So I basically said, you know, and then he got the manager. Manager got involved, and they ended up giving him everything he wanted at my expense because I had to do the work. And then later on, my manager called me in the office, and he says, Jay, do you even want to work here? And I said, you know what? I don't.
You're fired.
And so he fired
me. That's how Jay left The Apprentice.
So it was fun. But
did you rip your blue shirt off and be like, yes!
No! But I found myself, of course, at loose ends. I had no job. So I took...
So you go back into the Best Buy and offer advice to people as a customer?
No. I got a much better job, you know, as it turned out. I got a much better job. But then at one point when I was unemployed, after the really good job, I was briefly unemployed. So I was doing contract work. And so I got this contract job to go work at the Compaq warehouse.
Ah.
And what they wanted to do is they were doing a project to see they're in their returns warehouse, and so they wanted me to go through all these computers that were being returned from Best Buy. And basically, my
shoes on the other foot now.
For about 6 months, my job was to just take these computers, put them up on the rack, fire them up, and determine why they were returned. Hmm. Why were they brought back? And so there were computers that were infected with viruses. There were computers that had missing parts and stuff. And I've sorted them based on what the reason why I thought they came back. What, you know, a lot of them were, you know, they just didn't want it or they couldn't use it or they messed up the software. No big deal. But the ones that were like missing memory, missing CPU, had different chassis shoved inside. I had a nice big stack of those, and HP was able to take that and go back to Best Buy and said, you're not getting credit for these.
Yes!
Payback! Finally. So take that, Best Buy.
Yeah!
What's your best story, Groovehouse? You never talk anymore.
Yeah, you were a tech guy.
No, you were a tech guy for a major store of some kind. I don't want to reveal it if you don't want to say.
Oh, gosh, I'd have to think. I mean, it was pretty innocuous. It just wasn't, you know.
Oh.
Nothing to report.
My first tech job was pretty lame because it wasn't really a tech job, but they pitched it as a tech job. I was in high school, and I grew up in a really small town, and the biggest company in the town was a real boomer bust thing, where they would get a contract, and so they would hire a bunch of people that did like welding and like large manufacturer stuff, and then they would finish that contract and they wouldn't have another contract, so they'd lay everybody off. And so it's always just like boom bust, whatever, like
boom bust,
yeah, all the time. It's just a cycle. But anyway, so it was in a good period, and so they had and this was like 80 from 84, something like that, 85. And so they were like, oh, we really need somebody who's good with computers to, you know, to do this. And so somehow my name got pitched to them. And so I went and talked to them. They were like, yeah, you'll come here in the evenings and use a computer. And I was like, oh, okay. And I'm getting paid. I even got more than minimum wage. I was getting $5 an hour, which minimum was $3.35. So that was pretty awesome. And so I went there, and they're like, okay, here's what you need to do. We need to print out our, I don't know, some kind of daily reports or something. So there's a computer, and it hooks up to this, like, 132 column? Was it 80 and 132 column printers?
Sure.
I think it was 132. Why not? I think it was 132 column dot matrix form feed printer. And it was loud, you know. But so they pad it in one of those like padded boxes.
That's definitely prettery.
So they had it in one of those padded boxes, so it was a little bit quieter. So basically, this guy, I don't remember if I started the print job or if he started it before I got there, but I would go there around 5 or 5:30. Everybody was pretty much gone. And I would sit there and make sure that it printed okay for like an hour or 2 hours while it was printing. And then when it was done printing, I would leave.
Hmm.
That was it. That was my
string.
Very important tech job.
Print manager.
I found something interesting. It's slightly different. I made a discovery. So a lot of people on Facebook have been saying, like, hey, we're leaving the country, we're going, whatever. I was like, why? And it looks like the Sega that hasn't been made in forever, there's a Brazilian company that's making the Sega again. So it's for sale in Brazil. You can go to Brazil and get it. It's an exact clone of the original Sega Genesis abroad. I think it wasn't called the Sega Genesis. What was it called? Like the Mega Drive, I think. So exact clone. Sega said yes, and the only addition they're doing, so they're not putting HDMI on there, they're not doing anything. All the original adapters, all the original everything, they're wired in an SD card that's going to ship with like all the original Sega Genesis games that are worth something, like Altered Beast and all the Sonic games and Golden Axe.
So people have to leave
the
country to get it?
Probably not, but I mean, that's why I'm assuming people are saying, hey, I'm going to leave the country because the Sega's on sale in Brazil.
They're going to go to work for Sega and make this.
Or no, just run down to Brazil, buy a Sega, come back. Yeah, bring it back.
How much they cost?
About a hundred and change.
Is this like this isn't like the little mini Nintendo?
No, this is. It is a clone almost to everything. It's a straight up knockoff clone of the original Sega. And the weird thing is that Sega came in and said, "Yeah, that's cool, do it."
Huh.
So they're doing it.
Nice. And it comes with some games.
Right? It comes with 22 games on the SD card.
Did Sega force them to do licensing? Like they're paying Sega licensing? I mean, they would have to, right?
I don't know. I don't know. I know that I've used to travel to Brazil a little bit, and I would see like iPods where it looks like just like an iPod, but the Apple, the byte was on the wrong side of the Apple, or like it, you know, had like a weird extra button, or just, you know, like something wasn't quite right. So there is definitely, or there was, maybe not anymore, there was a bit of a piracy problem in some of the areas that I was frequenting, like some of the tech markets and stuff like that.
Like the country of Brazil?
Well, no, maybe this was mainly, like, it may have been, like, I went to, like, the tech market in Rio where everyone goes. It's this huge 8-story thing. Mostly, it's like every other stall is you can, like, refill your printer ink cartridges at the time or do whatever. But there was, like, a lot of, like, gray, I guess what I didn't know was gray market. It wasn't being sold as gray market, but was gray market.
Or complete counterfeit.
Device. Or complete counterfeit.
Yeah, just complete counterfeit. No gray about it.
Yeah. But they're making it down there. So there is a culture of this kind of thing. It's not like
that's
China.
It's like the Chinese tech markets,
yeah, but it's
right.
Kind of like that. The point where I remember, like, this was a while ago, before, like, really file sharing really hit off here. I remember, like, going there, and I was like, hey, can you recommend, like, a good place where I could buy, like, some CDs because I want to get gifts to bring back home? And, like, why would you buy music? That's literally what everyone said. Why would you buy music? I'm like, okay, I get that. He's like, he's a hacker pirate guy. I'll go ask someone else. And they were like, a grandmother. Why would you buy music? It's like, I don't know. Can you give me some MP3s, please? And I'm like, no, we use Ogg. Okay, give me some Ogg.
Although, yeah, Brazil was pretty into not wanting to use Microsoft. Like, they were big.
Oh, yeah,
big,
yeah, the whole government,
to, like,
went
government
Linux.
Ran on Linux and stuff.
They like Orkut instead of Facebook. I think it went okay. I don't know.
Wow, they really got into Orkut.
Yeah.
Nobody else, but.
They really did.
Yeah.
It mainly became, and that's how I had friends on there, and they were all on there, and that's how most of it went Portuguese. And that was one of the first things where I remember seeing a lot of discourse between, like, English speakers and Brazilian Portuguese speakers, because English speakers were like, hey, guys, let's keep this in English. It's an English platform. But the numbers of Brazilians were there. It's like, why? Why should they? It's like, you know, 4-1, 5-1. Let it be Portuguese.
It felt like 20 or 30 to 1.
It was probably like that, because I posted like 5 things. And actually, all of my stuff was pictures of me in Brazil. So it's like, okay, I was part of the solution or the problem, depending on how you saw it.
Wow.
But I kind of want one of these. Yeah, it's not like the cheapy things where you plug into the TV. This is legit knockoff, if you can have a
legit
knockoff.
Does it have a CD?
No, just SD card. That's it. Mm. I mean, yeah, I assume it. No, the original one had a. It was a spinning
top
CD, right?
CD,
yeah,
I think.
I remember I modded mine a long time ago to be able to take burn CDs, and that was a really big deal. And not that we would ever do this, but there was a time if you wanted to, you could either borrow games or go rent games, and then, you know, burn the games.
Can you not order these things and have them shipped to America?
No, you can. It's, I'm just joking.
Wow, Jay.
No, I'm just curious.
Yeah, you can. No one, okay, everyone listening, you don't have to leave the country. This is the message.
That's the real message.
Don't leave the country. Stay put. We'll be okay.
No matter how bad things get and your desire to get counterfeit Sega
Altered
gear.
Altered Beast, you're looking for Altered Beast.
You don't have to leave the country.
Any kind of
Beast
game
Swap,
console.
Licky, Golden Axe, Shadow Dancer.
Well, see, that you turned it into a message of hope.
Turbo Outrun, it is a message of hope. Decap Attack, that's an actual attack. They had a game called Decap
Attack. Decap Attack.
As opposed to the
Decap Attack.
As opposed to the Decap
Attack.
Which is like,
Yeah, there's some guy I'm not familiar with, Bonanza Brothers. I'm not familiar with Aeroflash, so I might have to go revisit some of these games. I never had this. Like I said, I got one way, way too late. It was like a Black Friday sale. I waited at your big box store in line way, way too long. But I did walk out of there with like the Genesis, and I think it had a modem and maybe even a keyboard. Or am I getting that confused with the Dreamcast?
The Dreamcast did. Yeah. I'm not sure about that one. I don't know if the Genesis
I don't
had
think the
that.
Genesis did. I think that's Dreamcast.
The Genesis
had what?
Genesis didn't have any kind of networking stuff.
Well, was there
an aftermarket add-on
There was a modem. There was a Sega Genesis modem. And there was a whole service around it. Let's see.
So that probably won't be brought back up, but that'd be really cool if someone wanted to co-in.
Sega MegaNet.
The MegaNet.
And the Telegenesis modem.
MegaNet
is what it was. Yeah, the Sega Mega modem was what it was.
What was the retail price on that back in the day? Can you see? It was out of my price range.
Let's see here. Originally set to debut shortly after the console, the device was pushed back to July 1990 and given a price tag of around $100.
Yeah. When consoles weren't much more than that, were they?
Yeah, about the same price, I guess. But that was like, I think that was, I may be misremembering this, but I think that's one where you could actually like get games to play over the modem. Like, mm-hmm. you didn't have to have the cartridge. You could actually like play online games.
Not having ever had one, I don't know. It depends on, I guess, how big those game ROMs were.
I know that was one of the things with Dreamcast was that was one of the selling things about mm-hmm. the newness of the Dreamcast.
You can make the internets. Make internets happen from your Dreamcast.
Mobile games? They'll never take off. Downloading games? No. No.
How can such a thing even be? I never had a Dreamcast. What was the other one? Sega Saturn was the intermediate one. Mm-hmm.
The last game console I had was an Atari 2600.
You didn't have a Nintendo?
I never even had a Nintendo. Nope, I'm older school than that.
Wow. I'm sure that there are some gaming clubs or organizations in town that do this, but at some point we should bring out like some old school consoles to a geek gathering and just, you know.
Or, you know, now they have emulators and you can get all that stuff.
Blasphemy.
Put it on a Raspberry Pi.
Just bring your...
No, I'm going to borrow someone's truck so I can load up the Donkey Kong arcade cabinet and then we'll very gingerly bring it to where we're playing. That's mobile.
I just want to play Wizard of War. That's the game I like. There's a Flash version, but it's not the same.
Just not the same thing?
Now, the Flash version of... I never know how to pronounce it. Kix. Q-I-X.
Kix.
Quakes.
There's no U.
Yeah.
I think it's just Kix.
I think it's
Quisp.
Q9. Q9.
But that game, the Flash version is really accurate compared to the arcade version. That's fun.
Did you ever play Adventure? Were you a big
Adventure
player?
Awesome.
I never played
that. 600?
No, I never played
or
that.
Or Atari VCS, as you would have called it back in the day.
I got the key, get chased by the dragon,
yes.
Get the castles.
No, I never did. The games I mostly played, so I played, I was a big fan of Activision. So I played like,
River Raid?
Barnstorming, Pitfall.
Pitfall was fun.
I almost said Crossy Road. Chicken Run.
Wait, was that the one with the chicken in the road? I think that was called...
Yeah,
that was Freeway. That's what that was called.
No,
it was Chicken Run, I think.
Oh, there was one called
Freeway.
Was
it Chicken Run the one that was the Donkey Kong ripoff?
Because the one that was Frogger but with chickens was mm-hmm. called Freeway.
Are you sure?
I'm absolutely sure.
It's been a long time since I've played it, but I thought it was called...
No, let's make some Googles here and find out.
There's a 2000... November 3rd game, Dame Chicken Run. PS1, though, so probably not.
Yep, no, here we go. Activision Classics, Atari Freeway. Here, I'll just play some play some noises from it here. This is what it sounded like.
I would have no idea. It's been so long. Yeah, the only thing I remember with the Activision games back then that was cool was if you got a high enough, they set a score, and if you got a high enough score, you could take a picture of the TV screen and you could mail it in, and then they would send you back a patch that was for that game that said, you know, that you were a hero.
Like an actual fabric sew-on patch.
Yeah, like you saved the chickens. I had one for the Freeway. I had one for Pitfall. I had one for, I don't know if I had one for Barnstorming or not. But it was funny because you would try to take a picture with a camera and it would flash, and it never worked, so we always use a Polaroid. We would use a Polaroid to take the picture, and then we could see that the picture came out correctly, and we would mail them the Polaroid to get the patch.
That's kind of awesome. I miss stuff like that. I never had any of those,
though. I'm pretty sure I don't have those patches anymore.
That would be cool if you did. Like, we could wear them today, and it would actually be awesome again. Stick them on your motorcycle jacket and be, like, legit cool.
Until I got beat up.
By whom? Who would dare challenge someone who is clearly such a skilled video game player?
I saved Pitfall Harry I don't know how many times.
I saved Leisure Suit Larry I don't know how many times.
That's a different game system. That was different.
That was a computer.
Yeah.
You guys were playing your console games. I was the computer guy, game guy, and then everything changed.
I was a computer guy, but I had a Commodore 64. Commodore 64 had the best graphics at the time.
Sprite graphics.
Yep.
Did have sprite graphics.
So I had the game, was it Forbidden Forest? Which was, it was weird because it was kind of a 3D shooter where this guy's in the forest and you kind of could like rotate him. So instead of just going left and right, you could kind of rotate him to shoot kind of into the screen. But I had it on cassette tape. And so you had to load it off the cassette tape. And it took like 20 minutes to load into the computer off the cassette. So basically, like, I want to play Forbidden Forest. And so you would stick the cassette tape in and type the like thing to load it off cassette.
Load 8-star, whatever.
No, the 8-star comma 1 was the disk drive.
Oh.
This was off the tape. I don't remember what the tape drive one was. But whatever it was that you put it on there. And then you basically like went outside and played for like 20, 30 minutes. And then at some point you came back and you'd check on it. And if it wasn't finished, you'd go back and keep playing. But at some point you come back and you'd hear the music. Intro music
and
playing,
and
then you knew you could come play it.
That's just beautiful. Never had a tape drive for my IBM PC because I was part of the PC master race even back then.
Wow, those things were expensive. There's no way I was getting one of those.
Yeah, we had
a tape drive.
No,
IBM
PC.
Had what my dad brought one home from work, and that was like our first PC.
Although that is what they had at school when I took. I took a class on, I had to take typing for a semester before I could take the data processing and computer class, where they taught you BASIC. But the thing is, I had taught myself BASIC on the Commodore 64, so we would get, like a 30, 45 minute lecture, and then we would get our homework for the week, and then we would have 5 days, 4 days plus that part of that day to do the homework. And the thing is, because I'd already taught myself BASIC, I would pretty much finish the homework in the class, usually the first day, sometimes it'd be part of the end of the second day, and then I would have 3 to 4 days where I was done. And so my teacher actually ended up saying, hey, you kind of do some stuff. I teach this other class where I teach like people that are going to become secretaries to do 10 keypad entry and stuff like that. So she's like, do you think you could like write a program that you could pick random numbers to like pop up on the screen and they have to use the 10 keypad and it keeps track of their score? And so that's what I spent like most of the rest of that semester doing. I would do my homework, and then the rest of the days I spent writing this program that would pop up, and you would pick tens, hundreds, thousands, or random, and it would pop up a number and you'd have to enter it on the 10 keypad. It'd give you 2 or 3 seconds to do it, and then at the end it would give you 10 of them, and then at the end it would tell you your, how many you got right, how many you got wrong.
Wow. Talk about all the games and everything that's gone on today. Some people at home are probably going like, hey, you know, I know about Tim McVeigh. I feel like going out and doing what Tim McVeigh did a while ago. Are you guys familiar with what he did? He was a guy in 1984 that got, like, he got more than a billion points on Nibbler. It's actually, there's a documentary out. It's not that Tim McVeigh.
I was going to say, I'm familiar with his high score.
Most unfortunate name ever. But yeah, it's actually, the movie is called Man vs. Snake, The Long and Twisted Tale of Nibbler. And Nibbler is just one of these niche games that for some reason they didn't reset the scoring. So you could roll over a billion points and keep going on a single quarter. But to do it, it would take like a day or two of playing. And some of these guys, when they would go, and actually this was before there was like a world high score thing. And it kind of centers around this one arcade, I believe it was called Galaxy Arcade, that started putting out like a newsletter, like printed material in magazines. And if you got, kind of like what Flicted was saying, if you got a high score on something, you could take a picture, send it in, and they would track who is the best in the world, more or less. And this was also the first arcade to have everyone kind of come in and start playing, you know, like these championship things. But yeah, they talk about one of the guys, like his first attempt, he played for, I think, a day and a half and started hallucinating. Like he thought the snake was coming to get him, and he couldn't. He also saw like there were lines going on there, and he gave up. So, I mean, what it took to get these guys through, and perfect playing too, to get through like a day and a half of playing was fairly impressive. They would actually get enough lives to where they could go take a bio break, like go tinkle or go do whatever, and then get back there as quickly as they could. But it was a really cool documentary. And also gives new meaning to Tim McVeigh.
Does it have any real live
footage of
them playing?
Yeah, they've got some old interviews, and these guys.
When did that documentary come out?
It came out, it's September 2015, so it's been out about a year.
What's it called again?
I saw it because it's hit Netflix or Hulu. It's somewhere you can stream it for free, but it's called Man vs. Snake. And they do have a lot of, like, pictures and some video footage from, like, I think it was, like, you know, circa 1982 is when this was going on. And then they talk to him now. And then there's, not to be all spoilery, but there was even some contention as to the race, to where some person, I believe, like, possibly South American, maybe, you know, some, I don't even know, some hombre somewhere, said that he actually beat the record, but didn't photograph it, didn't, you know, get it the right way. So there's contention within the thing. And I think they come back for a head-to-head. And that's where I stopped watching, but the first hour was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's on Netflix.
Yeah,
it
Netflix.
Is. I just added it.
It's worthwhile, yeah.
Now, I remember when I had my first exposure to a computer. No, I did not expose myself to a computer. In 1977, there was a TRS-80 in the
Trash-80, yeah.
In the guidance counselor's office, and I got, like... But when I was looking at a computer, I was like, I can never do computers because I can't do math. I'm not good at math, so computers scared the crud out of me. But I got to playing with this thing.
And now look at you.
I still can't do math. But I learned a little basic, and unlike Flicted, who wrote a program that was useful, I figured out how to make random numbers generate on it. And in my mind, I wrote this thing that just caused random numbers to scroll by, and as the numbers are going by, and it turns into wavy lines. And I thought, this is exactly the thing I need to make a space movie. I mean, it's just everything was going to be built around this computer as one of the consoles, like on a Star Trek bridge or, you know, on an Enterprise bridge or something
sense
like
to me.
That. Yeah, it totally made sense to me. But then my friend Bill Smith wrote a program in BASIC that allowed you to play Battleship versus the computer, and you had to load it off of a cassette tape. And the game itself didn't take up a lot of room, but he wrote in a routine in there that caused it to, like, if you beat the computer... All it would say is, okay, so you won in text. Just, but if you lost, it put big reversing black, you know, and white, you lose, flashing, which took up more space on the tape than the actual game.
Nice.
So you've about 1 in 3 times of trying to load this game, which took about 20 minutes to load from tape. It was on a 30-minute tape, so it took 30 minutes to load up. It would crash, you know, halfway.
Don't be mean to the losers, people. That's the takeaway here. Or to the winners.
Yeah,
play nice.
If it was just a, you know, a kinder, gentler game that wanted to get along with everyone, it wouldn't crash all the time, wouldn't break down. All right, well, that music tells us it's time to get out of here. So we've had a big success tonight talking about what we talked about and not the other stuff. But coming up next, the other stuff.
So bum, bum, bum.
You've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Link.
And he's
Brutus.
See you next Wednesday night.
Hello, gods and goddesses. You're all invited Saturday, November 17th to Little Love Gathering Benefit for KPFT, an evening of music, art, and love for KPFT. Live music includes the Gian and Charlie Experience, Luvia Dreams, Kindred Spirits, Glass the Sky, 10,000 Chiefs Under the Sea, and Buddha Deerhead. See and purchase artwork by 31st of February, Kylie Ariana, Wes Cloninger, Dimensional Dyes, and Sweets by Darcy. You can get the details on Facebook at Little Love Gathering. Come see parts of the arts and music community you may have missed and show your love for KPFT. Join us at 9208 Rasmus Drive, Houston, Texas, Saturday, November 19th from 7 p.m. to closing, and support local artists, musicians, and KPFT.
Support KPFT by donating your unwanted vehicle. No matter if it's a car, motorcycle, boat, or RV, when you make a donation, your vehicle is resold at an auto auction and the proceeds help to support KPFT programming. To donate your vehicle to KPFT, call 1-855-KPFT-CAR. That's 1-855-573-8227. And your car doesn't always have to be running either, but it does have to have an engine and be towable. And you must be the legal title holder. There's no cost to you, and you help out the station you enjoy with your vehicle donation. Again, to donate your vehicle to KPFT, call 1-855-KPFT-CAR. That's 1-855-573-8227. Thanks for your support. This is KPFT Houston.